about 1840. The place? St. Louis, Prairie du Chien, or another Mississippi River port. The person? A riverman, a traveler, a Marco Polo of the Mississippi and its headwaters.
Now, you listen to me. I know what I'm talking about. I've been there. And there ain't no better spot in the world for a sawmill. Three rivers to float your log. And trees? Trees, man, thicker than a stack on end. Both banks, just waiting to be cut off and rolled in. Man, there's so many trees spitting distance from the banks of them rivers, you could keep a double mill going 2 years without a team of horses. And if you wondered about water power, man, you'll stop wondering long before you get there. You can hear them falls a half mile away. You'd think they was coming down Rib Hill. That's how the town got its name, from the falls. Big Bull Falls, they call it, after the noise. But even before you hear the falls, you'll see Rib Hill. Man, she really sticks up proud-like. It don't matter where you are. If you're looking at Rib Hill, you're looking up, plenty. And right aside the hill is Big Bull Falls, at least like they call it now. But it wouldn't surprise me none if it was changed before you got up there. Last time up, I heard some folks call it Wausau.
Is Wisconsin Profiles, a recorded series brought to you on alternate weeks at this time by the Wisconsin College of the Air. Here's your narrator, Ray Stanley. In the profile of Wausau, we're combining the two techniques used thus far in the series. First, with the help of the radio hall players and the tape recorder, we'll reconstruct a few scenes from Wausau's past, letting people from the past tell their stories as they might have told them if confronted with a microphone. Secondly, we'll bring you up to date by introducing you to people from the Wausau of the present, people whose voices have been recorded for this program by a State Station documentary team. One of the things we generally try to do in a community profile is to highlight the aspects which make that community different from other Wisconsin communities. But we found that nearly all northern communities have in common something so important that it cannot be ignored. That something is the ghost of the great pine forests. The histories of most northern towns up to a certain point are merely paragraphs or a page in the history of the lumber industry. But from that point, the histories diverge in ways which come to light when you ask the question, why didn't this town collapse when the lumber industry disappeared? Our program then will attempt to do three things: to show how a few important trends got started in Wausau, to bring you some of the flavor of the lumber years, and to reveal why Wausau remained prosperous after the lumber years were over.
Standing now in a sawmill operated by Mr. George Stevens on the east bank of the Wisconsin River at Big Bull Falls. Would you tell us, Mr. Stevens, how many years you've been living here?
Oh, it's only 5 years now. I didn't come here until 1839.
1839, and what was the population of Big Bull Falls at that time?
Well, as a matter of fact, there was no population at all. At least nobody who lived here all the year round. Even for another year after that, there wasn't anybody here except me and the fellas working for me.
Well, it's pretty much of a one-man town then, wasn't it?
Oh, I guess you might say so, yes. But I never really thought of it that way because I knew there'd be more people coming in most any time.
I see. Well, that leads us to something we're always interested in learning in the different communities we visited. Namely, what brings people to a community? Why did you come here, Mr. Stevens?
Oh, I think nearly everybody here would have about the same answer to that question. They were talked into it by somebody who lived here or traveled through here. Now, me, for instance, I happened to meet a fellow in St. Louis by the name of Wakely, who had a trading post for a while on the river south of here. I was just in from New York, and Wakely was fresh down with a lumber shipment from a mill near his post. Now, he told me about Big Bull Falls, and it sounded so good, I came up to take a look and decided to settle down.
I see, yes. But what I was getting at was, what are the physical characteristics of the locality that make it an ideal place to settle down?
Oh, that was, of course, the timber, the pine, and, well, many other things, too. There was a combination of things here that made it perfect. Plenty of water power, and then these three rivers here. You see, we have the Big Rib and the Eau Claire coming into the Wisconsin right here, and that gives you more territory to choose from where you can cut right near the banks. You don't have the problem of getting the logs to the water. Oh, but getting back to the business of talking people into coming here. I just got three fellows from St. Louis to come up here. I expect they'll pass the word farther along, and before you know it, one of these days we'll have ourselves a city.
George Stevens, who founded both Wausau and Stevens Point, is also credited with launching Wausau's first era of industrial development, the lumber era. The lumber story is familiar to nearly everyone in Wisconsin. It's a story filled with colorful men of ruggedness and riches, and a story seldom free from accusations of short-sighted exploitation. But more about that in the second part of our program, when we'll examine the lumber era from a 20th century perspective and see what took place in Wausau when the pine forests were gone. Meanwhile, we'll pick up the threads of other developments woven hesitantly into years dominated by the lumber industry. One of these threads, although it existed earlier, made its first appearance in 1867. A man named August Kickbush was responsible.
Nein, this man will not lumber, Jack. This man do not come all the way from Germany just to cut trees. Oh, no, to cut trees, yeah, but only to clear the land, to get money for buying horses and plows. Once the land is cleared and the sun can shine on something besides the tops of trees, then they grow crops of things to eat.
The people you brought with you from Germany, Mr. Kickbush, are they all farmers?
Yeah, most of them are.
Well, then it would seem to me that they'd choose another part of the country where difficulties in clearing land are not as great.
Oh, nein, my friend. It is here they are needed. Men always do better where they are needed. Here there is opportunity to get money right away by selling logs. And they can work in lumber camps in the winter to get money until the farm is a success. Oh, this is the best place for them, the best. Even the land and the climate is much like they are used to in the Vaterland.
Speaking of Germany, I understand you got into trouble with Bismarck on your last trip over. Would you care to tell us about that?
Yeah. I'm no longer welcome in Germany. The Emperor does not take it kindly when I take 700 people away to America. He said to me to leave, to get out, stay out.
Well, do you plan to make another trip in spite of his warning?
Oh, no. not me. The Emperor says it.
He means business?
Yeah. The Emperor says it, he means business. It does not matter. Others will go that he does not suspect. I am too busy for travel anyway. And I accomplish already my purpose.
August Kickbush accomplished his purpose, and in doing so, made 1867 one of the most important years in Marathon County history. For these German farmers were the first to make farming a successful enterprise in the county. They led the way in an occupation which eventually was to surpass the lumber industry in economic importance to Wausau. More about farming later in the program. It may have been about this same time that another type of farming got underway in the Wausau area. A type far more specialized, more
barrel.
Unique.
Here's all you need.
Oh, I see. But what I really wanted to talk with you about...
Holds water. Old flour barrel, do.
Now, I wonder if you'd care to say something about
it. Put some water in it.
Some water?
Oh, about a foot, maybe.
A foot of water in an old flour barrel? Well, what's all this supposed to...
Of course, that all depends on what size rocks you got.
What? Size?
Rock. You got a big rock, you need more water.
Oh.
Rock's got to stick up out of the water.
Hmm.
Just a little. Enough for one rat to set on.
Rat?
Yeah, just one rat. And you go to the top of the barrel, and there you got a hole. Now, you follow me?
I'm at the top of the barrel.
That's right.
In a hole.
The size of a mess plate. Like they use the logging camps. Can't buy them, but well, I reckon you could swipe one easy enough. Get a job and quit and take the plate with you.
Of course.
Now, you make a little hole each side. You put a wire through the holes.
Yes.
String it across the hole.
The hole in the barrel?
Yeah, so it swings back and forth on the wire. It stays level with the top of the barrel when it ain't swinging.
I see.
Well, then you bait it.
What?
You put some bait in the middle of it.
This is for the rats?
And maybe a plank alongside for him to crawl up on. Now you make it easy for him there, you see. Then that rat comes along, goes for the bait, and the plate turns around and kersplop. Do you know what he does then?
Well, I suppose...
He sets on the rock, wants to dry off. Then another one goes for the bait and kersplop. You know what he does?
Curse plop?
He fights with the other rat for the rock. Wants to set there himself. Now, fighting gets noisy, see, and the rest of the rats get curious. They all want to see a good fight. By this time, you don't need no bait. They come to see the fight, and in they go. Curse plop. Only one can set on that rock, see, so the rest of them all drown. Wipe out the whole colony in one night.
Except for the big one on the rock, I suppose. What do you do to him?
I don't know. Never thought of that. Reckon I'd just add some water and let her set a while.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Are there many rats in Wausau?
Well, now I don't know.
I suppose there are, of course. But I haven't heard of any. I haven't seen any. Have you ever seen a rat in Wausau?
By jeepers. Come to think of it, I ain't.
But anyway, you've got quite a reputation around here for your ideas in trapping and for your mink and fox raising. As far as we know, you're the first person in this area to produce fur by farming, so to speak. Would you tell us how you happened to get started fur farming?
No rats?
No. Well, we don't have very much more time, and I think it's rather important, this business you've started. Won't you say a few words about how you happened to start fur farming?
Well... When I was a young fella, I used to do a good bit of trapping. And I didn't just trap and trap like some folks.
No.
I did some thinking about trapping.
Oh, yes, so I gathered.
Well, I was having trouble with mink, losing them. Steel trap hurt them so much they chewed their legs off to get away. So I said to myself, why don't I fix it so as it holds them but don't hurt them? So I ups the size of the trap. And I wraps the jaws, using old shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it held them. They didn't chew their legs off no more. And then, one time for the fun of it, I tries the same thing on fox. And what do you know? One morning, I finds a young she-fox just a-setting there, looking at me sweet-like. Trap not bothering her at all. I walks right up to her. And she don't yip, don't snarl, don't do nothing. Pats her on the head. She just whines. Like that, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what can I do? I can't bust her in the head when she does like that. So I takes her home. You know what?
What?
1 month later, little foxes.
And that's how you got started?
Yeah, five of them, cute as pie. Yeah, that got me started. And pretty soon I was growing mink, too. Now I'm set. Why should a fella run his fool head off trapping out in the woods when he can grow him in his own backyard?
The preceding episode does not necessarily have any foundation in fact, but that might be how fur farming got started. We know it did start, and it did grow to become an important part of Wausau's rural economy, an important part of the nation's fur economy. We'll follow up on that later in the program. And that, incidentally, is where Soviet Russia will get into the act. In our next episode, we'll pick up the beginnings of an industry which is more truly unique to Wausau than anything else we touch upon in the program. The year is 1875.
We're talking now with Mr. L.S. Cohn, one of the pioneer lumbermen in the Wausau area. According to what many people have told us, Mr. Cohn, you're branching out a little from lumbering.
Would you tell us something about your new plans?
My new plans, huh? Well, I don't know. I think they got mighty old since yesterday. They practically died a natural death.
I'm not sure I follow you on that. You mean you're closing up your quarry?
Well, actually, I never got started. I did a little blasting, but only to make sure the vein was more than just a few feet deep.
Oh, and it wasn't?
Oh, yes, it was. I went down 20 feet, and there was no apparent end. Then I made the mistake of consulting the experts. This little sample here, this sample from the quarry, I sent to Martin Company at Joliet, Illinois. They're supposed to know all there is to know about granite. And I got it back yesterday with a word that, well, nothing good.
You mean the granite?
Well, the granite's good, all right. The fact is, it's too good. That's their opinion. So good that I can't possibly hope to find a workable vein. It's the best granite they've ever seen, and for that reason, they think I can't hope to find a workable vein.
Well, but the fact that you've gone down 20
feet... Well, that doesn't prove a thing, actually. To be worthwhile, it should go 100, 200 feet anyway.
Well, then you're going to drop the project?
No, I'm afraid I'm not going to drop it. I'll be taking a chance, but with the lumber supply running out, we've got to take chances.
Lumber supply running out? Well, that's an unusual attitude. The general opinion around here seems to be that the timber is inexhaustible.
Yeah. Well, we're cheating ourselves out of a future if we think that. The easy lumbering around here is done with already. We're pushing back farther every year. I've got logs coming in from places I've never seen right now. You give us another 20 years, maybe more, and then we've got to start. Rather, we've got to start right now, looking for other things to do. Otherwise, when the pine is gone, Wausau will go too. That's why I'm taking a chance with granite. Other people will have to do the same sort of thing, or before they know it, there won't be any Wausau.
Mr. L.S. Cohn started two important trends when he ignored the opinion of experts and opened a granite quarry. He started the trend away from lumbering toward more stable industries, and he started the utilization of what was to prove one of Marathon County's most abundant resources. We'll follow up on that later when we meet the manager of one of America's leading granite monument plants. For our next episode, we move forward in time 25 years to March 31st, 1900, a date which marks another turning point away from the lumber industry.
Speaking to you now from the plant of the Central Wisconsin, Wausau's first newspaper. Standing beside us is Mr. R.H. Johnson, editor and publisher. We came here to talk about newspapers, but we found that everyone seems to be excited about something else. In the background, we can hear the printing press, but it seems that this particular sound is considerably more important today than it has ever been previously in Wausau. Mr. Johnson, would you tell us what makes the difference?
Yes. Wouldn't it be all right if you just read it from the paper here? We've got it all written up.
Well, but we'd like to hear it from you. Why don't you read it to us? Here, let's see. If you just read us this first paragraph here, would you do that?
I suppose so, if that's what you want. The Central this week comes to its readers printed on paper manufactured by the Wausau Paper Mills Company. The first product of its mammoth plants. The completion of these splendid paper mills is worthy of more than a passing mention, as it is one of the most important of Wausau's industries and marks the opening of a new era of development.
And why, in your opinion, is the opening of Wausau's first paper mill so important to the city?
Well, we're about past our peak in lumbering now, you know. I think we hit our peak here a few years ago. There are more mills now, but they're not turning out as much lumber. And it's costing a good deal more to produce it. They have to go farther for good stands. But for paper, there's plenty of pulpwood right around here.
Well, does it seem to you, then, that paper manufacturing will eventually replace lumbering in Wausau?
I think so, yes. There's plenty of water power here. And as I was saying, there's plenty of pulpwood for many years. When the lumbermen went through, they didn't hurt the pulpwood. And, well, if we do run out, Railroad transportation will be good enough so we can always branch out for a supply.
You think paper is here to stay, then?
Yes. I think it is. Lumbering might be about over. But I think paper is here to stay.
Was here to stay, and it turned out to be the most important of the industries to replace lumber. A few years after the episode announced so proudly in the central Wisconsin, the Marathon paper mills were established, eventually to become one of Wisconsin's leading paper makers. Later on, we'll meet Mr. D.C. Everest, president of the Marathon Corporation. The next episode has to do with the growing up of a hill and its coming of age as Wisconsin's only mountain. The year is 1921, the year Wausau's Kiwanis Club was organized.
It's just broken up now, and the Kiwanis have formally decided on their first project, a decision which may someday be of very great importance to the people of Wausau. As you know. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me for intercepting you in this way, but we'd like to get your reaction to the plan adopted here tonight. Would you care
to say... someone have voted for it. There are plenty of them. Ras Parker is his idea, not mine, certainly.
Yes. I beg your pardon.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. Please, disregard what I just said. You've discovered, I guess, I don't favor the project. I didn't mean to put it quite so... I didn't mean to be so angry about it.
Oh, well, that's all right.
If you care to go ahead, I think I can be sane about it.
Well, we just wanted to get, in the words of a member of the club, a few of the details concerning your purchase of land on Rib Hill and your plans, what you plan to do with it.
Rib Hill? It isn't Rib Hill anymore, you know. It's become a mountain. It hasn't grown an inch in a million years, but by calling it a mountain, it becomes a mountain. Oh, there I go again. Excuse me. Yeah, we did purchase some land on top of the...
Mountain?
Yeah, we bought from the Gensman Estate 3/40s, and they donated a fourth. So the Kiwanis Club now owns 160 acres of the most inaccessible land in Marathon County.
Oh, but you have the highest point in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, I suppose we do. That hasn't been definitely proven yet, but I suppose it's the highest.
Well, what does the club plan to do with the land?
Well, what can we do with it? That was my contention all along. You can't get to the place. I know only two men, mind you, who've ever been to the top.
Well, there are no plans for building a road, then.
A road? We don't even have enough in our treasury to buy 3/40s. Now, the whole thing is completely worthless. It was all done for the sake of something to do, something to keep us together, they say. A project for the sake of a project. 160 acres of worthless land.
Kiwanian in the preceding episode was purely fictitious. We know only that there was opposition to Charles Parker's plan, and we presented the story through an antagonist instead of a protagonist. You'd have a hard time finding the antagonist now. The Kiwanis, the whole city of Wausau for that matter, is mighty proud of Rib Mountain. Charles Parker was president of the club in 1921 when the land was purchased. He's still living in Wausau, and a little later we'll hear from him what happened to the land. As you've probably noticed, our program up to now has been devoted to showing how things got started in Wausau, to depicting turning points in Wausau's history. Well, this is a turning point in our program. This is where we go back to pick up some loose ends. One of the responsibilities we delegated to this part of the program was to look back on the lumber exploitation from a 20th century perspective. Listen now to an expert in the industrial uses of wood, Mr. D.C. Everest, president of the Marathon Corporation, one of Wisconsin's leading manufacturers of paper.
Lumbermen of the 19th century have been constantly criticized for what some termed the devastation of the forest. Too many people view what was done in the 1800s in the light of present-day developments. When one stops to think of bringing logs to Wausau to be sawn and then floating the resultant lumber down the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers to such points as St. Louis, there to be sold in a highly competitive market to people born in the East and Midwest who knew good lumber, you can readily realize that a lumberman could only afford to cut the highest quality of lumber the trees in the forest would produce. Unless one wanted to commit commercial suicide, there was absolutely no sense at the time of attempting to utilize all of the trees or all of any one tree which grew in the forest. It was all a part of the economy of the country at the time these men were operating. The long life of the structures built from this selected cutting of quality timber is mute testimony of the soundness of the philosophy of that era.
But regardless of the soundness of the lumbering philosophy, many Wisconsin towns collapsed when the lumbermen were gone. Here, Mr. Everest gives one reason why Wausau didn't do likewise.
The thing which kept Wausau in its forward position and also kept it from becoming a ghost town, as did so many villages built up in the same way, was the fact that the men who had made some money in lumbering were content to remain in Wausau and invest their money in new enterprises, which were also based on the utilization of wood. Paper mills, veneer plants, box plants, sash and door plants, and many others, using wood in various forms as a raw material, have superseded the sawmill.
The wood-using industries which replaced the sawmill now provide about half of Wausau's jobs. So the community's future is as closely tied up with wood now as it was in the 1800s. Listen as Mr. Everest describes a few of the factors which assure the future of Wausau's wood-using industries.
Today, there is almost complete utilization of all species of trees grown in the forest. Research laboratories are constantly at work on the further utilization of everything the soils of the forest area will produce. Concurrent with this effort, there are innumerable agencies working to rehabilitate the forests of Wisconsin. Federal, state, county, schools, and private agencies are doing a wonderful job along this line. Wausau, while it has many industries which contribute greatly to its economic life, will continue its main dependence on wood, the supply of which I now feel is assured. It will come about through the adoption of good forest practices and the treating of timber as a crop, as God intended it to be.
Unlike so many lumber areas, especially those farther north, Marathon County was blessed with some of the best farmland in the state. Earlier on the program, we mentioned the German immigrants who found the county to their liking and showed the way for other prospective farmers by making a success of the business. They formed a nucleus which multiplied, and now Marathon County ranks first in the United States in the production of American-type cheese and third in the number of milk cows. The first-ranking county, incidentally, is Los Angeles, and Wisconsin's Dane County is second. But a more specialized type of farming, and one more unique to Marathon County, is fur farming. Since World War II, the fur-growing business has perhaps undergone a more drastic change than any other business in the county. But the change is felt little outside of the business itself. 10 years ago, fox was the most lucrative item for most growers. But talk about fox to the fur farmer of today, and the answer would be something like this.
Well, fox, of course, is more or less of a dead issue right now as far as fur farming is concerned. We're just lying in wait till it comes back. And but mink right now is the most popular fur, and the one that's being raised more so than any other one. Fox is just unprofitable for the last 4 or 5 years.
That was Art Byron, who runs a farm at Schofield, just outside of Wausau. Through the window of the room where Mr. Byron's voice was recorded, we could see $150,000 worth of pens empty. This is why they are empty.
Right after the war, the Russians shipped in a tremendous amount. It broke the fur market in the United States. I don't have the figure, but it was, I believe, over $500 million. So you can see what that does to our domestic market.
Current developments are likely to instill a good deal of bitterness in a man who finds himself in economic competition with Russia.
I don't know just why we buy Russian fur, give them a dollar exchange in order to someday that they can throw it back at us in lead or steel, whatever they're going to do, but our government does that. I believe if you look at the statistics on it, that over 25% of their dollar exchange is utilized through selling furs in the United States. So, and the thing is, Russia used to be one of the best markets for the luxury furs, that is real high-priced, good furs. But today, you can't sell any in Russia. They export them all, and they're all produced on slave labor. So, it's kind of tough competition for the fur farmer here that wants to deal with them.
Marathon County fur growers have found that mink is the best answer to foreign competition. So that's where they're directing their efforts. Now Marathon County is the leading fur-growing county in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin furnishes 70% of the nation's farm-raised furs. We heard a few minutes ago that one of the reasons for Wausau's continued prosperity after the decline of lumbering was the reinvestment of lumber profits in other wood-using ventures. But the lumbermen got even farther from their field in some investments, a notable example being L.S. Cohn, who started that granite industry on lumber money. That was in 1875. In 1949, Marathon County Granite Companies totaled sales of $1,500,000. We talked with Mr. Hjalmar Olsen, Secretary and General Manager of the Anderson Brothers and Johnson Company, and asked a leading question. Why are you located in Wausau?
Well, the reason we are located here is because, of course, we're so close to the granite, which is located in Marathon County. And, of course, there isn't any other granite in the world, any place, that can compare with Marathon County granite.
The most convincing testimonial to the quality of Marathon County granite comes from a competitor in Canada. Company which boasts of having granite similar to Wausau red granite. Monument dealers buy almost the entire output of the Marathon County quarries. Hardly any of it is used for building. However, another type of Marathon County rock goes into the building industry at the rate of about 400,000 tons annually. The company sending it out is the Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company. From a quarry at Brokaw, a few miles north of Wausau, they take a rock called the gray wacky, grind it into small granules which are colored, and sold to manufacturers of asphalt roofing. These granules provide both color and protection for asphalt shingles. Chances are, no matter where you live in America, if you have asphalt roofing, you have a little of Marathon County over your head.
To give you some idea of the magnitude of this business, in 1950, we expected to produce approximately 400,000 tons of colored roofing granules. If you were to put all the tonnage into one pile, it would make a pile of 1,000 feet in diameter and about 370 feet high. Or it would cover approximately 1.5 million homes with new roofs. Also, this to move all this tonnage at one time would take 250 train loads using 8,000 boxer copper cars. Make a still more graphic statement. If we took these roofing granules and laid them end to end, it would make a path to the sun and back again. And you'd have enough left over to make a path around the Earth 600 times. To come back to Earth, we make a lot of roofing granules here in Washington.
That was Mr. Lauren Cannon, branch manager of the Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company. The statistics he gave you might, by their very magnitude, suggest a fate like the one suffered by lumber. We hinted as much to Mr. Cannon. This was his reply.
Well, we have, as far as the rock is concerned, we have in the neighborhood of at least 100 years of rock uncovered. Present rate of operation, and there's no question in my mind but we could double that if we wanted to.
Parts of Marathon County are being scattered all over the nation by the monument and roofing granule industries. But there's another rock, Marathon County's most prominent rock, that stays behind. Instead of being shipped out to people in other parts of the country, people migrate to the rock. And that rock, of course, is Rib Mountain, Wisconsin's highest point. A few minutes ago, we heard how the newly organized Kiwanis Club, under the leadership of Charles Parker, bought 4 40s of land on the top of the mountain. Listen now as Charles Parker, a retired banker, tells what happened to the land bought in 1921.
After we had acquired the site, the question then arose as to what use made of it. About that time, it occurred to us that if we could get the state to take over our proposition, that would naturally develop along the lines of getting a road which the public could use, and it would become a local picnic ground. Time came that we did deed our interest to the state with the provision that a road would be constructed to the summit that could be traveled by the ordinary automobile. I think Rib Mountain is now nationally known since in the developments which have followed later, primarily through the efforts of our local Chamber of Commerce, we have now established a ski slide, and we do have participation coming from many other states around us.
That was Charles Parker, and it was Walter Rail, Secretary of the Wausau Chamber of Commerce, who in 1935 secured aid from the National Park Service and the Wisconsin Conservation Department to make Rib Mountain a winter sports center. The responsibility for winter sports promotion has now gone to Raymond Bull, Assistant Secretary, who now describes what Rib Mountain has to offer.
Well, the facilities at Rib Mountain include 7 ski trails varying in length from 600 feet, and one goes close to a mile. That's from the top down to the shelter house. And everyone is designed to take care of the intermediate as well as the professional. On the average, we would say that we get a little over 10,000 out-of-town skiers in here every winter. So probably that's a modest figure, but that would take care of our season, which runs usually from December 15th to March 15th. And we average roughly 1,000 skiers for Saturday, 1,000 skiers on Sunday.
Ray Bull's job, of promotion involves more than persuading them to come to Rib Mountain. It involves telling them when to come and when not to come in terms of ski slide conditions.
The Chamber of Commerce issues a weekly snow report that's mailed to all skiers, ski clubs, department stores, railroad stations, radio stations, newspapers, and so forth. The report is mailed each Wednesday from our office, and it contains information as to the exact snow conditions at Rib Mountain at that time. We have an on-the-spot check of all the trails and the open slope, and that information is passed on in this report. And anyone that's interested in receiving the report, all they have to do is just drop the Boston Chamber of Commerce a note, and we'll be glad to place them on our mailing list. There's no charge for the report, and you'll receive it each Thursday.
Since most skiers are young people, you're probably wondering by this time, can they afford it? Well, all facilities on the mountain are free, except the ski toll. It's $1.50 a day for adults, but only 50 cents a day for people under 19. This year, plans are being made to provide a dormitory for young skiers, 125 beds in a steam-heated building. The cost per person, 50 cents a night. Food is served at a restaurant in the ski lodge, again, at prices designed to fit the pocketbooks of students. Our program leaves Rib Mountain now, but it stays with the Chamber of Commerce and goes back to the topic of industry. We found, among the current projects of the Wausau Chamber of Commerce, what may be the most workable industrial development plan in Wisconsin.
From my knowledge of industrial development procedure in Wisconsin, ours is a little bit different than the average. In most cases, communities have set up what they call industrial foundations. These are organizations which provide capital for plants that wish to come into the community. Our approach has been a little bit different. We buy the land so that it is available for any organization which wishes to come in, and we sell it to them at our cost. Many times, new plants coming in find that they are held up for the cost of property if somebody finds out that a large concern wishes to buy it. This way, we not only reserve the land for future development, but we are able to sell it to prospective new industries at modest cost.
That was Walter Rail, Executive Secretary of the Chamber of Commerce. We've worked with Chamber of Commerce secretaries in most of the communities we visited, and we consider Mr. Rail outstanding among them. Outstanding for the amount of printed material on Wausau he was able to produce at a moment's notice, and outstanding for his articulate knowledge of the needs of industry. The industrial development project Mr. Rail was talking about a moment ago is known as the Schofield Industrial Area. Acres of land owned by the Wausau Chamber of Commerce in the village of Schofield, 2 miles south of Wausau. As Mr. Rail said, the land in this area will be sold at cost to industries looking to locate there. 6 concerns have taken advantage of the offer during the 5 years of its existence. The emphasis is on diversification. All 6 of the plants are in different lines of endeavor. In this, we find a continuation of the philosophy which kept Wausau out of the economic doldrums after the lumber industry collapsed.
Our policy of encouraging diversified industry in the case of the Schofield industrial area is merely a continuation of a trend that we have tried to follow for a good many years. The original founders of Wausau, who made their money in the lumbering industry, realized that they could not continue to build a city on that basis alone. So they very wisely reinvested this money in diversified industry. So that today, we have 5 major groups of industries represented in the 60 which are located in the Wausau metropolitan area. For example, paper employs 2,500 people. Metalworking in 11 firms, 1,891 people. Woodworking in 7 firms, 1,500 people. Stone products, 500. Foods, 500. And all others, 1,500. This is an indication of extreme diversification and one which makes for uniform and steady employment in our community. We think this is very healthy, good for everybody, including the worker.
Early on our program, we stressed the importance of rivers to the economy of Wausau. And then we dropped the subject as though the new diversified economy had eliminated the need for rivers. On the contrary, the river is doing far more work now than it could possibly have done in the lumber days. At that time, the river's energy was confined to the space between its banks. Now, electricity spreads the energy to every member of the community. However, more than electricity was needed to bring the Wisconsin to its present value. The Wisconsin River was unruly and unpredictable. There was either too much of it or too little. The Wisconsin needed a cross, and it got one. The river is now controlled from an office in downtown Wausau. The boss is M.W. Kyler. His organization is the Wisconsin Valley Improvement Company. Essentially, this company is a private business version of the CVA. Various power users on the Wisconsin pooled their resources to construct reservoir dams on the headwaters. And now surplus water from flood stages can be stored to keep the flow constant during dry seasons. Power users now buy water from the company on a pro-rata basis. This service, of course, is not confined to Wausau. Plants anywhere on the Wisconsin or its headwaters can benefit from it. They all benefit from a formerly erratic river domesticated by and controlled from the headquarters of the Wisconsin Valley Improvement Company in downtown Wausau. That concludes our profile of Wausau. It's by no means complete. It wasn't intended to be. Our intention was essentially to show the transition of a community from the lumbering days to a prosperous, diversified economy, highlighting somewhat the aspects which make Wausau different from other Wisconsin communities. Profile of Wausau was produced by Carl Schmidt, narrated by Ray Stanley, and written by Les Nelson. Music was by Patricia Hazard, and the roles from Wausau's past were acted by Tom Detien, Bob Hummey, Ray Stanley, and Myron Curry. Roy Vogelman was the on-the-spot reporter. For valuable assistance in the preparation of this program, we wish to thank Dr. Henry C. Arnsbrock of the University of Wisconsin Extension Center and Walter Ray of the Chamber of Commerce. Our thanks also to the Wausau Record Herald Company for the centennial edition of their newspaper, which provided material profile. This program is one of a series entitled Wisconsin Profiles, a recorded presentation of the Wisconsin College of the Air.